Hi, and welcome back to Foreign Office. I'm Michael Weiss, Director of Special Investigations at the Free Russia Foundation. This week, I'm joined actually by two colleagues and friends with whom I just concluded a months-long investigation into the Wagner Group, Yevgeny Prigozhin's core of not just Russian mercenaries, as we found out, but Ukrainian, Moldovan mercenaries as well. This investigation took us to Kyiv, first and foremost, where reporting on my GRU book in September, I met General Igor Guskov, who was the former head of the analytical department at the SBU, Ukraine's Domestic Security Service. And since leaving the service, he has continued his work, which now encompasses some 7 years of mapping and anatomizing the Wagner Group. He had compiled a database along with his colleagues of over 4,000 known Wagner fighters who have been deployed all over the world, Donbass, obviously, Syria, Libya, Central African Republic, Mozambique, et cetera. And he was all too happy to share this work with us on the condition that we gave credit to him and his organization. And I figured, look, the best stuff in this database, which contained both the full names, first name, patronymic, surname, dates of birth, country of origin or nationality, but also in some cases, last known home addresses. So I thought the best way of going forward with an investigation like this is find dead Wagner fighters and try to contact their family members. This scoop, if you like to call it, or this acquisition of data, coincided with a trip I had also done to Estonia. And one of my partners in journalism for the last several months, if not over a year now, has been Holger Runema, who's a brilliant Estonian reporter with Delfi Estonia. I think it's the largest news outlet in the country. Is that right, Holger? Or have I oversold you?
Hi, Michael. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
Right. And I said, look, you know, I've got this tranche of information that I can't really analyze on my own. And would you like to partner up? And obviously, Holger is preternaturally fascinated by all the same stuff that I am having to do with Russia. So he happily agreed. And over the course of several weeks, the investigation expanded and we brought on, first and foremost, Matthias Carlson, who's also on the show today. And he is, Matthias, I'm going to have you say it again, because I will just screw it up. Attached with a very well-known Swedish publication called
Dagens Nyheter. It's the biggest morning newspaper in Sweden.
There you go. And so, yeah, I mean, and Matthias has fluent Russian and obviously also very interested in the subject matter. And so we kept kind of bringing on new international investigators. We partnered with Moldova Rise, is it, Holger?
It's Rise. Yeah, yeah. It's a small investigative journalism outlet in Moldova.
Yeah. So basically our methodology was, okay, we can't go to Russia and report on the Wagner Group for reasons I shouldn't have to explain on this show anyway to this audience. But we could easily go to Ukraine and Moldova and wherever else that some of these fighters might have come from and see if family members, survivors are willing to talk. And lo and behold, they were, at least quite a number of them. I mean, in the piece, we've got half a dozen families, whether it's sisters, brothers, fathers, or mothers. But I think we ultimately ended up interviewing close to a dozen, 11 or so families around the world. I want to turn it over to my colleagues to talk about, you know, their part of the investigation. But to my mind, just as a short note, what was so fascinating about this is Wagner has been a kind of black hole for reporters for quite a while. You see headlines such as the Wagner Group doesn't exist because it's not an incorporated entity anywhere. And, you know, it exists almost at the level of rumor or speculation. We know the commander, Dmitry Utkin, is a former officer in the GRU. We know that he called this paramilitary organization the Wagner Group because he has a fondness for Nazi iconography. And obviously, Richard Wagner is or was Adolf Hitler's favorite composer. So there's a kind of weird welter of you know, scuttlebutt and some documentary evidence. New Lines magazine published documents that were obtained from a tablet device found in Libya by some BBC journalists, which was kind of fascinating to get a sense of what these guys are reading and what they're interested in, at least virtually. But I think our story, our investigation really put faces to this organization. It put, this is probably a bad metaphor to use in these circumstances, but meat on the bone, if you like. We found people who have lost their relatives to the recruitment, drive of you know, Mr. Prigozhin's mercenary corps. And we also found that they got up to pretty horrific acts. One of the families we interviewed is related to a man who appeared on a video in 2017 that was taken in Homs, Syria. This video became notorious. It went viral, in fact, because it showed about five Wagner operatives bludgeoning a Syrian man who turned out to be a deserter from the Syrian military, bludgeoning him to death with a sledgehammer, dismembering his hands, severing his head from his body, stringing him up by his feet, and then setting him alight, all while they're sort of giggling and chortling in the background. And then apparently there's a longer video showing them playing soccer with the guy's severed head. I mean, this is something out of ISIS, right? And except it was a Russian military organization. So we interviewed that guy's family. One of the things that comes across is that, you know, everybody starts out as a human being. All of these guys came from rather impoverished, socioeconomically backward areas in the post-Soviet space. And, you know, whilst they might have had some criminal background or, you know, got up to no good in their childhood, nobody remembers them as being a psychopath. Nobody remembers them as being capable of war crimes or crimes against humanity. So it kind of shows the evolution of somebody who gets sent into foreign battle spaces and morally, ethically, and I guess intellectually kind of descends into some darkened hell. Anyway, I want to talk to Holger and Matthias because they were really kind of the integral components of this investigation, went around meeting the families themselves. Guys, it's great to have you on. Thank you for interrupting your Christmas holiday to do this. And yeah, I mean, look, I'm very gratified to see the response to this investigation. I mean, I knew it would do well, but it's done amazingly well. I've gotten messages from other journalists saying it's a tremendous coup and, you know, it kind of broke New Lines' computer service for a while. And I know that it's done high profile business in your respective countries. Tell me from your points of view, I mean, because you've been into this from the very beginning, what was the most surprising thing about what we found out, you know, in terms of whether just looking at the raw data from that spreadsheet that I sent over many moons ago or from the shoe leather reporting of going door to door, meeting the survivors?
Yeah, maybe like to start with a little bit of correction, and then that's also an answer to your question, is that you said in the beginning that the family members were happy to talk with us, but no, I think that we didn't meet anyone who was happy or happy to talk with us on that 10-day trip that we took with Matthias in Ukraine and Moldova. But they were willing to talk with us, and I think that was actually a surprise. That we were discussing with Matthias before the trip that we might end up like spending a lot of time in Ukraine and Moldova, driving thousands of kilometers, and in the end coming back with nothing. But I think that a lot of why these people were actually willing to talk with us, and some people also rejected, they didn't want to talk with us at all, but mostly they were open to talk with us. But I think the reason was that they hoped that we would know more about what had happened to their close ones.
Yeah,
because most of the families whose doors we knocked on, their close ones had been killed fighting for Wagner PMC. But at the same time, the relatives, the widows or the parents or the sisters or the brothers, they really up to today, like even 3 or 4 years later, we don't have basically any clue of how their close ones, how their family members ended up dead somewhere in Syria, for example. And that is the reason why they invited us in, that they hope that maybe we can share some new details, some new facts to them, actually.
And I mean, you know, if they lived in Russia, they might have been a little more unwilling or reluctant to talk to us. But the fact, I think, that they don't, that they live in European countries, made them more amenable. I mean, these are people who have been told, don't ask questions, don't kick up a fuss, don't go to the media. If you antagonize the Russian government in any way or try to seek answers about what happened to your relative, you'll be denied the right to go to Rostov to visit their gravesite. Right. I mean, all these guys that we managed to track who fell on the battlefield are buried in the same place.
Yeah, I think that's a very important factor, that the graves of these killed mercenaries are usually somewhere in Russia. And for people from Moldova or Ukraine to go visit the graves, they need to cross the border.
Yeah.
And then one mom who we talked with, whose son had been killed in Syria, she told us that she was basically said that if you ask too many questions about what actually happened, then you will not be able to go to Russia anymore. And then that's it.
Yeah. And I mean, we were in some cases able to give a sense of at least, well, from the data that we've got, here's when they died. Here's where they died. And we were able to kind of reconstruct, you know, was this, for instance, that now famous operation where Wagner tried to conduct some sortie against US-backed forces in Deir ez-Zor, eastern Syria, and then they were all wiped out, including through the use of American aircraft. I mean, we did kind of provide answers where we could to these families, right? I mean, I assume that most of them, if not all of them, were completely blinded as to where in the world was my son or my husband deployed? You know, was it Ukraine? Was it Syria? Was it Libya? We did have that information as best we could check it.
Yeah, we had some information, and a lot of times these mercenaries themselves had told their families that we were going to work in a taiga to cut down forest or something like that, or we would just go on a business trip for several months. Sorry, mom, I will not be taking my phone with me. I will call you when I'm back. But it wasn't the son calling back. It was the son's comrades. Letting the families know that actually their son or brother or whoever had been killed in Syria as a mercenary. It's one thing to take a look on this story from the, I don't know, like Russian side, from a political side, from a macro side. But I think that what our story manages to also show is that the micro level of the tragedy of families, that we met very few people who are openly, I don't know, politically active or openly pro-Kremlin or pro-Putin or something like that. Most of the families that we met actually were politically completely, they didn't have any interest in politics. They were just trying to get on with their lives. And I think that also explains why their family members had eventually become mercenaries, because they didn't see that perspective in their lives. It was like difficult to handle in the places where average salary is maybe $400, $500 a month, where we don't have education, where job opportunities are scarce. It wasn't like an ideological move for these people that we talked with to become mercenaries, but it was a very practical decision.
And I mean, Matthias, let's talk about the way that Wagner recruits fighters. I mean, they essentially put up classified ads on job-seeking websites, right? And they couch the assignment in sort of weirdly ambiguous, awkwardly worded terms. You will have an armed security responsibility, protecting objects on the territory. They're not saying we're going to send you to Syria to go fight insurgents or jihadists, right? I mean, but it sounds both nebulous, but also kind of exciting and glamorous at the same time, which I think is part of the draw for a lot of these guys, right?
Yeah, it's almost like a code that, you know, certain people would understand what it actually means. And there is also some, I mean, details in these ads that gives hints to, for example, they say that you are supposed to have a armed guard service, but you don't need a weapons license, or you don't need a license to be a guard. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious it's not in Russia they will be guards, but somewhere else. And but in one case, I mean, we talked to the youngest of the Wagner guys that died. His name is Mark. He's from Kharkiv. And we talked to his mother, and he actually told her before he left for Syria that he was going to Syria, and that he described it as a peacekeeper assignment that he was. But of course, the mother, more or less understood the reality of it.
Right. And I mean, a lot of these guys do have military backgrounds. I mean, I remember General Guskov saying that if you drill down into some of, you know, the kind of the history of the classified ads that have gone up, Wagner actually likes people with criminal profiles. They are seeking out sociopaths because the work, obviously, you know, you're being sent to a war zone under the veil of plausible deniability. There is no technical or formal attachment to the Russian Ministry of Defense, much less to the GRU. They kind of encourage them to go out there and do things that militaries governed by the laws of armed conflict simply would not do. I mean, again, witness this video that circulated of five Wagner fighters mutilating, torturing Hamadi Buta, who wasn't even on the other side. He had been seconded into the Syrian military as a reservist and just said, I don't want to fight. I'm just going to desert, and tried to run away. And they caught him. And this is what they did to him on camera, with the encouragement, according to the European Union, which just sanctioned all of Wagner 2 weeks ago. It was Dmitry Utkin, the commander, who told Wagner, chop this guy up and film it. This is not, you know, that's why when people compare it to other PMCs, I mean, the most notorious one is, of course, Blackwater, which has also committed war crimes in Iraq as determined by a U.S. court. Wagner is something a little bit different. They go above and beyond in brutality and in, well, just complete indifference to how they treat their quarry when captured, whatever. Can we go into a little bit about sort of the, no mother likes to remember her child as a war criminal, right? And of course, I mean, these guys were matured in the cask of a God knows what kind of camaraderie is applied here. You know, talk a little bit about what you, I mean, from the investigation, it sort of reads like they all have cookie cutter backgrounds. Growing up in some post-Soviet miserable town or village, not being educated well, often the family, the mother and the father, it was a broken home, a dysfunctional home, or a violent home where the father would beat the mother. I mean, these are people who almost seemed, in hindsight, destined for no good, right? It was just a question of who was going to get their tenterhooks into them first.
Yeah. In one of the cases, we spoke to the both the mother and the father of one guy called Yevgeny Antipov. And it's one of the cases with the criminals past. I mean, he was part of the tragic events in May in 2014 in Odessa, where you had the anti-Maidan and the Maidan, the people battling out there. And so he was wanted by the Ukrainian police for rioting and with a deadly outcome. So he was wanted for a crime that could give him up to 15 years in prison in Ukraine. So of course, there was no way he could ever go back. So I guess he would be a very suitable person to recruit. And we know that he first came to Eastern Ukraine and you know, from with the fighters there. And so we don't know exactly how he was recruited to Wagner, but you know, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, he had no way back anymore. One of the interesting interviews that we had on the road was actually in Moldova with a psychologist who has analyzed the psychological and also like social backgrounds of mercenaries who have been convicted in Moldova. It's not only mercenaries fighting for Wagner, but also for all kinds of other paramilitary units who were, for example, taking part in the war in Eastern Ukraine. She said that one of the unifying elements for all these people convicted, or close to 20 of them, is a lack of empathy. But these people are unable to control their emotions. They are very cold in communicating. And that is the main reason why these people are able to kill, end of quote. And I think that struck me. This is the clearest as it can be, that who is able to become a mercenary, chopping off other people's hands and heads and burning the corpses, but the total lack of empathy.
But that goes to Guskov's point. I mean, lack of empathy is one of the signature symptoms of sociopathy, right? So they're looking for people who are going to do this kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and there are a lot of criminals there are criminals fighting in Wagner, who allegedly have been given an option, that either you go and fight for a private military company such as Wagner, or you will face X amount of years in prison.
Right.
So what kind of choices do you have?
And then when you get out of prison, you'll be brutalized enough that we'll bring you back into Wagner as well.
Yeah.
No, it's kind of extraordinary. And, you know, again, the murkiness of what they get up to on the battlefield. I mean, we still only have, you know, a fraction of events and operations that they took part in. I mean, the insane drive to try and take the Conoco gas plant in Deir Ezzor, despite American warnings to stand down, they kept pressing on, right? So it was a kind of, they're using these guys, I think we use the expression cannon fodder, but also they're kind of they're personnel in a kind of Russian proving ground for military operations. You know, what can the MOD get away with? What kind of enemies and adversaries is it going to encounter on the battlefield? And let's send Wagner out first to determine, you know, what their vulnerabilities are or what their resolve and deterrent capability is. They are expendable people, right? Ultimately.
Yeah.
They're not buried with kind of state honors. I don't know if we got into this, but there is an internal award system. I mean, I remember Guskov explaining to me that there are three different medals. One is for acts of valor and bravery, which God only knows what that constitutes among Wagner fighters. One is obviously if you were killed, you get, you know, an award or sent to your family or whatever. And then another is for injury on the battlefield. So there's a kind of tripartite structure for medals pinned to the chest, but these have nothing. There's no outward connection to Russian state. It's only an internal thing. And I wonder, do these, you know, are there kind of like veterans of Wagner going to be sitting around the campfire in 25 years, remembering their exploits in Syria and Libya? Or, I mean, it sounded to me that everybody kind of comes away quite miserable, or they're offered this fame and fortune. And in some cases, you know, they start to make the wage they were promised. What is it? 2,000 rubles a month. But then the salary steadily decreases, if not gets cut off entirely. So they're kind of left stranded, captive to this core, and not even getting the money that they signed up to get.
Yeah, but we've been like browsing or going through, I don't know, hundreds of Russian social media profiles as part of this investigation. And one thing that you actually can see there is that these mercenaries do actually form like friendship groups, and they post all the photos like going out fishing and traveling and stuff like that. So I think that in the end, the only thing that you will have are people who share the same fate and the same stories as you. So unfortunately, I think that 25 years from now, if they are still alive and if they are not in prison, they will be sharing fireside conversations with each other.
The ones that live, that is.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things, I mean, this is a nice tidbit, I think, for the listeners. We didn't get into this because I don't think we were able to confirm it. Christo Grozev of Bellingcat was a partner of ours for a very specific reason, which is when I got the database, General Guskov said, look, you know, these guys are traveling under false passports. At least some of them, a handful of them were traveling under false passports. And what he managed to realize was that a handful of them had the same numerical sequencing in their false passports as the, or was in the same numerical grouping as at least one of the assassins or would-be assassins of Sergei Skripal. I can't remember if it was Mishkin or Chapiga. But anyway, this was kind of a blockbuster disclosure. Again, we weren't able to chase it up to our satisfaction, but it suggested, at least to the SBU's mind, that, look, the idea that this is a private military company, that this is some kind of entrepreneurial thing that run by Prigozhin is nonsense. They are lock and key with not just the Russian government, but the GRU in particular, right? If they're getting false identities that are manufactured by the same kind of printing press, passport printing press in Moscow that's giving passports to members of Unit 29155, the sabotage assassination unit stood up in 2009 to conduct Mukhridelo around the world, clearly Wagner is just an extension. And I think we even have the former head of the SBU saying, don't think of them as, you know, some standalone entity. I mean, they are the GRU.
Yeah, and then besides that, we need to remember that we are also using a lot of the weaponry that we are using in the places, as, I don't know, Libya, Syria, or other like African countries where they are, that they are using Russian military weapons. And that's not stuff that you could buy somewhere commercially. You need to get, you need to have it supplied from the military, actually. So there is pretty clear evidence about that. After we ran the story, I did a follow-up in Estonia about the Mali situation regarding Wagner having negotiations to open its shop in Mali as well, where there are also right now up to 100 Estonian soldiers helping the actual peacekeeping mission. And if a Wagner deal goes through, then Estonians would actually be, and Swedes and French and in the coalition, I think, there are like close to 15 or 20 countries. They would be basically fighting on the same side with Wagner, which would put all these troops or all these countries in a very peculiar position. But 2 weeks ago, we kind of put sanctions against Wagner, and then now we will be fighting in the same place. But anyway, what I was happy to realize when talking with the officials in Estonia and the Ministry of Defense is that at least in Estonia as well, we understand. I think it's quite the same as Vasil Kritsakvi, former general of SBU, told us that there isn't such a thing as a private military company Wagner. It's actually, it's just an extension of Russian authorities.
Yeah.
And then that's it. But you need to take the same look at the things that are happening in Africa, the things that are happening right now in Mali is actually very closely connected to the stuff that we are seeing happening right now on the Ukrainian border.
Oh, that's interesting. Can you get into that a little bit? How closely connected in what sense?
Well, basically, it's the question of right now. I'm not talking about my own analytics. I'm talking about quotes given to me by an official in Estonian Ministry of Defense.
Yeah, no, I get that. But I mean, what was he getting at? What did he mean, or she?
She, yeah. Well, the point is that Russia doesn't have any strategic interest as such in Mali. But why the negotiations between Mali, in Mali, between the transitional government and Wagner, so-called Wagner, going on, and then why there is a threat of Wagner going into that place, is that Russia wants to get the attention of France and some other countries away from some other places, such as Ukraine. So we are just trying to kind of flood the attention span and the timetable and the calendars that people have in places such as French Ministry of Defense.
Interesting. I mean, it's not the first time, by the way, that France would find itself on the same side of the fight as Wagner. When the French government and the United Arab Emirates were propping up Khalifa Haftar in Libya, especially during his assault or his push on Tripoli, the Russians had sent Wagner in to partner with him, even though, funnily enough, they thought the guy was a lunatic and a busted flush militarily. They were still helping him. So, yeah, I mean, it's this weird dance. The West is against Wagner and Russia and Ukraine, and to some extent in Syria, but in other parts of the world, particularly in Africa, where Wagner's been deployed, we find ourselves on the same side, right? Fighting jihadism. You know, to your point, though, about getting Russian military-grade weaponry, I remember one of the first things that Guskov told me was, if you go back to 2014, perhaps 2015, one of the key battles that took place in Syria between the so-called separatists and the Ukrainian government, Utkin was there and he was commanding the Wagner fighters, right? I mean, the Wagner fighters were kind of the first deployed in. And after the battle, where the Ukrainian government essentially wiped the floor with the Russians, Utkin, and they know this because they intercepted the communications, and this is publicly available on YouTube or whatever, but Utkin was radioing back to someone in Moscow saying, forget about the dead bodies, we'll take care of that later. Take your armored personnel carriers out of here, because these are vehicles that are only manufactured in one place. And if the Ukrainians publicize this, all bets are off. They're going to know that there's a direct Russian military intervention in East Ukraine.
Which again confirms what you said earlier, that these men are often only cannon fodder.
Exactly. I mean, they're sent in to sort of to probe the front line and see what the Russians can get away with. And, you know, I mean, dead bodies, no problem. But captured equipment, more of an issue. Just like the Buk that took down MH17, you know, where did it come from? What's next, do you think, for Wagner? I mean, one of the questions I've been asked is, well, if Putin does reinvade Ukraine this month, which seems, well, depending on what day of the week it is, increasingly likely or increasingly less likely, will Wagner be part of that fight? I see no reason why it wouldn't be. I mean, for all of the above, right? I mean, just easily disavowed. They're just volunteers, they're just separatists, they had nothing to do with Russia, and the willingness to do things that the average conscript would not.
Yeah, I think it was Reuters who reported just ahead of Christmas as well that several people involved in that process confirmed to them that actually Russia was setting up, was like taking or finding mercenaries to deploy them to Eastern Ukraine. And actually, when working on our investigation, we also got acquainted with evidence that suggests the same, that Russia was actively looking for mercenaries who would be deployed to Eastern Ukraine. And the salary offered to those people, if you have a proper military background in Russia, for example, was close to 300,000, was 300,000 rubles a month, which is somewhere around $4,000 maybe.
There's a king's ransom for most of these guys, but it also underscores the importance of that operation and, I mean, the risk entailed.
Yeah. What is interesting is that Russia may be kind of like sowing the same branch where it's sitting on top of a tree, that the same mercenaries, the most professional mercenaries are themselves, I think, increasingly becoming skeptical about the offers and about such jobs, no matter how high the salary is offered.
Right.
They know that they might be paid the agreed salary for the first few months, so that they can pass on the word and invite friends to sign up as well and stuff like that. But then they don't have belief that the payments would continue as agreed. And they don't, what's more important is that actually they don't have belief that they would be taken care of. They understand that they are mainly they are employed to carry out some dirty tasks, whatever sabotage or whatever stuff like that.
Yeah.
And in the end, if something happens, that they will be left on their own. No one will take care of them or their families.
Well, you know, one of the things that former SBU chief said was that, look, Europe has to wake up to the threat of Wagner, that this is not just going to stay in East Ukraine or in the Middle East and North Africa. It's very easy to train these guys up, dress them in civilian clothing, put them on a plane to anywhere in Europe, anywhere in the world, really, and have them get up to things that Russian intelligence officers or agents would do, assassination, sabotage, etc. And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is, again, everybody that we queried for the investigation did not live in Russia. At least the families didn't. So the childhood homes of these guys was Moldova, Ukraine. If there is a war, I mean, if you're Prigozhin or you're his, I suppose, paymasters or his commanding officers in the GRU and the MOD, and you're preparing for a war against Ukraine, proper full-scale invasion, the one thing to do now is to try to recruit people from Ukraine, have them sent to Krasnodar or wherever they're going to be trained up in Wagner facilities, sent back to Ukraine, and essentially have them act as fifth columnists, right? I mean, if they're soldiers of fortune and they're doing this for the money and the chance of glory and fame or whatever, why not? I mean, I suppose the only disincentive there is how many of these guys want to fight against their brethren. You know, it's one thing to go fight insurgents in Syria. It's another if you're born in Ukraine to fight fellow Ukrainians. But who knows? Again, you know, this lack of empathy, this sociopathic tendency that they all seem to share is pretty alarming. And that's got to be something, by the way, that the Ukrainian intelligence service is very worried about. You know, if our own sons are going off to serve Mr. Putin, would they stay put to serve him in the event of, I don't know, full scale invasion and occupation of Ukraine?
What he said, I mean, that they are warned their partners in the EU about these kind of scenarios where you would have Wagner guys coming in on different planes and on, you know, civilian clothes, like, and meet up somewhere and start doing bad things. I asked the Minister of Defense in Sweden about this, and they said, yes, well, this is a scenario that we are very well aware of, and that you know, we are preparing to meet these kind of threats as well.
I mean, because if you think about the evolution of Russian operations, not forget military stuff, but, you know, killings, sabotage, you know, arson, it makes sense. What can we do to kind of strip away the attribution? If our GRU guys are getting exposed because of photographs hanging on the wall of military diplomatic academy that wind up on VK or Facebook, let's just get random people with at least a basic skill set that meets our requirements. Let's train them. Let's make them more sophisticated in their methods, and let's use them. And, you know, we know what the Russian government line would be if these guys got their hands caught in the cookie jar, because we've already seen it, right? That provocation in Eastern Syria in, what, 2018, where dozens of these guys, if not more, hundreds perhaps, were killed, again, in a U.S. firefight with them. The MOD and the Russian Foreign Ministry line was, who are they? They're not ours. You know, they're just volunteers. They're holiday makers wandering the deserts of Eastern Syria. So it would be the same line if, say, you know, Wagner operatives were turned into the next incarnation of Unit 29155 and told, go out and make carnage. I mean, presumably they wouldn't be entrusted with things like Novichok or chemical or biological weapons, given, you know, who they are and their wild abandon. But I could easily see them conducting an assassination like the one that was just adjudicated in Germany against Zelenhan Kangashvili, right?
Yeah, I think they would be used for something like really robust and probably like large scale. Yeah, but as Matthias was saying, that Sweden like acknowledges a problem and is preparing Estonia the same. At least that's what I'm told. I don't know if it's I can't verify it, of course, like independently, but at the same time you must acknowledge that to prepare against something like that is like extra difficult to do. How do you do it? Guys flying in from different corners of Europe or the world, even if like countries like Sweden or visas to them, they will still get the Schengen visa from somewhere. And then it's like at some stage they just show up and then they are there. But luckily right now, I don't think that Russia would dare to do anything like that. I think that would be like stepping beyond.
So you don't think that they would send Wagner fighters to Europe to hop off?
Well, I think that right now it's a concern, but their hands are tied in Africa, Ukraine, and other countries. So I think that still EU and the NATO memberships are other stuff that should make them concerned as well.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem, though, that, you know, these guys are not completely impenetrable. I mean, if we've all read the Bellingcat investigation into the abortive sting operation the Ukrainians were going to run to try and capture them and fly them back to Kyiv under the guise of sending them abroad somewhere else to fight. Yeah, I mean, look, new minted fighters, mercenaries, nobody's going to know what they get up to until they get up to it, right? And they can be sent anywhere.
Yeah. And it doesn't need to be Wagner.
So, I mean, I've noticed in the last 10 years a greater willingness on the part of the Russian government to do things that they otherwise would not have done, at least in the 21st century. I mean, Litvinenko seemed to be kind of the beginning of a new phase of special tasks being exported abroad. You know, Skripal was kind of a bridge too far for many because it, I mean, the potential for collateral damage using Novichok in an English city that was shut down for several days as a result of this, blowing up ammunition and weapons depots in NATO territory in Bulgaria and the Czech Republic. It does not seem like there's a de-escalation in terms of, you know, Cold War style military technical operations conducted against the West. And it also seems like quality control has gone out the window. So why not use thuggish civilians who are given a bit of training and paid the kind of money that they would otherwise never make to conduct things that, you know, require brute force or, you know, that are, is going to result in bloodshed. It seems to me that this is not a case of alarmism on the part of a former SBU chief. This is just a very kind of logical sequence of events and a kind of an eminently likely prediction about what's going to happen in future. Particularly, again, if there's a war, think of what Wagner fighters could do, forgetting about just killing people on the battlefield. They could be doing things to try and destabilize a refugee situation or a migration crisis, which will result inevitably if there's an invasion of Ukraine, right? They could be sent for political destabilization operations in European countries that are, you know, suddenly discovered their hawkishness on Russia. You know, and it's important to note that, you know, Prigozhin is not just the paymaster of a mercenary group, and forget about the troll farm, which seems like ancient history. He's also doing political influence campaigns, right? Using cut out organizations that are meant to be apolitical. I mean, Holger,
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, that you're making. Yeah.
So I can see this as being kind of all sort of all encompassing. You've got your kind of roughneck goon squad in the form of Wagner. You've got your weird European, not NGOs, but what are the civic platforms that are stood up ostensibly to talk about the circular economy or post-COVID reconstruction, but in fact are being run out of the St. Petersburg back office that Mr. Prigozhin is in command of. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like its own shadow government or own shadow intelligence operation, except it's not, as we've been talking about. It's just essentially the GRU.
It would be interesting in investigation to see if they're trying to buy up European security companies, not you know, needing a Russian Wagner group, but have a locally established company with due licenses and everything. It would be interesting to have a look at more closely.
Well, I mean, isn't it the case that they're now trying to recruit from the ranks of the French Foreign Legion or from the former French Foreign Legion? So, yeah, I mean, they want people with European military skill sets, too.
Yeah. And I mean, if they would have a local a company, you know, like a security company established locally within the EU, they could do a lot more stuff, I guess. And with the case of, you know, I know for a Swedish case with Gotland, you have the big island in the middle of the Baltic Sea. They have been practicing scenarios where, you know, private security companies would take over the port, for example, in Gotland, as one example. I know this is a case of interest.
It seems like what's taken place is, especially in the United States, the new strategic doctrine is return to conventional military problems, right? Return to state actors after 20 years of fighting the war on terror and fighting so-called non-state actors. But in fact, there is this hybridization effect where state actors are now, in effect, standing up their own quote-unquote non-state actors, which are essentially just arm of the state to go around and do the kind of things that typically a special service would get up to, or a military unit. So private enterprise is filling the void here where governments have decided we don't want to send our own cadres out to do this. It's easier to just second cannon fire with money.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the same with the all the organized criminals. I mean, they're also using companies to do stuff, and it's much easier and better. And a company can never be charged with a crime. You have to charge a person. So in the end, it's very comfortable using the facade of a legit company.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, look, with respect to Wagner, the jig is up in the sense that there is no deniability any longer. I mean, both the United States and the EU say that this is a proxy of the Russian state. So if you're affiliated with Wagner, you're affiliated with the Russian government. But as you point out, it's not, this is just the beginning. There's going to be other Wagner groups that have to, we're going to spend 7 years looking into what they do before we can come to a confident conclusion that, oh, it's just another cutout. Right.
Yeah. There was one thing when you mentioned this with the GRU passports and the advertisement for new recruits for Wagner. It says in the Trebovanie for the service that you should have a passport, but it's not like it says it's welcomed if you have a foreign passport. So obviously they have some way of doing passports for you if you don't have it.
Right. Well, also, I mean, you know, you never know if they're taking the passports of guys that they've recruited and using them as legends for actual intelligence officers. You know, the Comintern in the 30s always wanted Americans and Europeans, because once you handed over your passport in Moscow, you never got it back. And whatever happened to you, it was irrelevant, but the passport was the important thing.
Another interesting, I don't know if it will be relevant for a podcast or not, but we identified in Estonia, let's say, 4 or 5 mercenaries. They were not Wagner mercenaries, but they were fighting in eastern Ukraine for different paramilitary units, such as Prizrak, which means ghost, and so on. And one of the guys fighting there, he was confirmed dead. He was handed out, like, about his death. The Estonian court system gave out the death certificate 2 years ago. But what we actually discovered right now, we ran the story just the day before Christmas, is that the guy is not so dead at all. He's very alive. He's posting photos of himself in eastern Ukraine. He's making career there in all the Donbas, whatever, desantnik organizations and things. There are news pieces of him coming out. So we have actually at least some people who have been declared dead, but at the same time, they are very, very much alive, active, and progressing in the same mercenary path. So what happens to these guys' identities? Someone will need to issue them new passports in other countries than Estonia. So I think that's also something to think, that we might actually have an army of officially dead people.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's very convenient for kind of bringing them back to life, but as under new identity. Yeah,
and then no background whatsoever, like no right. official background. European Union has said that you are dead.
And also, I mean, one interesting case with this from the video with they beheaded and tortured this the Syrian man, the Moldovan Vladislav Apostol, that is, you know, supposed to have died in the Battle of Kazan there in February 2018. But I mean, the Moldovan authorities are still investigating him for crimes. And I guess if you are identified as being a part of a very, really horrific war crime, it would be very comfortable to be listed as dead, I guess. I mean, who knows? There is no death certificate that he is actually dead. I mean, who knows if is he really dead or is he not?
Yeah.
I think that for me, like the important conclusion from this investigation as well is that private military companies such as Wagner will be used in the future. Like, it will be a common tool in the hybrid warfare toolbox. They don't need to be wearing the name of Wagner. As we know, Wagner itself is like unincorporated. But they will give states such as Russia a plausible deniability, and in conducting the tasks where they want to remain officially out of it. So I think that any awareness that can be done to investigate, to reveal, to uncover such efforts, I think that will be really good.
Well, I guess the other scary thought is that, you know, just because the Russians pioneered this doesn't mean that they're going to be the only country.
Sure.
Okay,
yeah.
Guys, you've been listening to Holger Runema and Matthias Carlson, my partners in a 4-month-long investigation into the Wagner Group. You've been listening also to Foreign Office, the name of this show. Thanks very much, and we will see you next time.